Before we get into today's episode, I want to invite you on a unique spiritual journey this Advent season. It's called Journey to Bethlehem, and it's a free 9-day text message series designed to prepare your heart for Christmas. Starting on December the 17th, and each day leading up to Christmas, you'll receive a short reflective message pointing you to the hope, peace, joy, and love found in the coming of Christ. It's completely free and a great way to keep your focus on Jesus this season. Sign up today at premierinsight.org/resources. That's premierinsight.org/resources. And now here's today's podcast.
Well, hello, good afternoon and welcome to Unbelievable with me, Justin Brierley. It's the radio show and podcast that brings Christians and non-Christians together for dialogue and discussion here on Premier Christian Radio every Saturday afternoon and, of course, anywhere in the world at any time via the podcast. You can find that at premier.org.uk/unbelievable. Before we meet our guest today, just a big thank you to anyone who was there at Unbelievable, the conference 2013 last week. What a great day we had in central London with a variety of speakers and over 600 people joining us at the brewery to learn, discuss and really enjoy a day of teaching. We're going to be telling you more about that a little later on in the programme. But what a great day it was. And I just wanted to say thanks to all those who were involved, who helped, who were on staff and who came, of course. So look forward to hearing more about that a little later on. Right now, it's back into the usual format of the programme today. I've got a Christian and non-Christian joining me today. They are both emeritus professors. One is Russell Stannard. The other is Steve Jones. Let's meet them and find out what we're talking about today on the show.
You're unbelievable.
We're asking today, can the Bible be retold as science? That's the subject of Steve Jones' latest book. He's the Emeritus Professor of Genetics at University College London, a regular columnist for the Daily Telegraph. Russell Stannard is in conversation with Steve today. We're also asking, in that sense, can science point to God? Russell is a Christian, former recipient of the Templeton Prize, a high-energy particle physicist. That sounds incredibly impressive, and we'll find out more in a moment. Professor Emeritus himself of Physics at the Open University. He's recently filmed a number of short videos called Science and Belief, The Big Issues, available on YouTube and at the RE Today website. We'll find out about that too. Gentlemen, welcome along to the programme. It's great to have you here today. Perhaps we'll start with yourself, Russell. You're both new to the show, but Russell, I've been following one or two things that you've been doing over the last couple of years. Most recently, though, you've got involved on YouTube, which is that a new world for you, YouTube and the sort of the way people disseminate information these days?
Yes, it certainly is. There are, in fact, two video series up there now that I've put up there. One is called Boundaries of the Knowable, which is looking at science and asking the question as to whether there are limitations to science. Is science always going to progress? We're born into an age of scientific progress, and one perhaps unthinkingly thinks that, okay, that's the way science is. It always, by its very nature, progresses. Well, is that the case? I think the answer for that is no, and it won't be, because one day we shall have answers to all questions. I think it'll come to an end when we've discovered everything that is open to us to understand.
So you don't have a boundless confidence in the limits of
science? No, I don't. I think that science is absolutely wonderful. I devoted my life to it, my working life to it. And I've written lots of books for children, encouraging them to take up science. I think it's a wonderful occupation. But I try not to get sort of too excited about it. And particularly when it tries to go beyond its own domain of expertise and starts to interact with spiritual questions, which is where the second video series comes in, the Science and Belief, The Big Issues one.
Where this is aimed more at schools and that sort of thing.
Well, it's aimed at schools primarily, and I'm in conversation with teenagers, both atheists as well as believers, trying to provide the kind of information that I think everybody needs to have in order to be able to make up their own minds on the issues. Mm. So these videos don't end up with any conclusions. Mm. They end up with questions to consider in the light of the information provided.
And how have they been received by those schools that have been using them?
Oh, well, I'm very happy to say that they've been extremely well received. We know that because there's been a big evaluation program involving 43 schools, finding out from the students how they reacted to it. You know, did they understand what I was talking about? And they did. Did they consider that the arguments were put across in a fair way, that I wasn't, you know, pushing my own particular agenda? And certainly it does seem as though the atheists watching it were just as happy as the believers that their point of view had been fairly put. And they seem to have learned an awful lot. And in particular, it's made them appreciate other people's points of view.
Sure.
It hasn't been a question of too many of them suddenly being converted or suddenly losing their faith, but certainly they are much more aware of how other people think, and they feel stronger in their own beliefs as to how to explain that to other people.
So if people want to find out more about that, I can say that you can go to retoday.org.uk/science and belief. That's a good place to start if you're looking for the videos and the resources that have been produced by RE Today Services, who were one of the partners, actually, in this year's Unbelievable Conference. But, Russell, we'll find out a little bit more about you in a moment's time and how you've sort of seen the intersection of science and faith in your own life. But my other guest is Steve Jones, as I mentioned, Emeritus Professor of Genetics at University College London, author of a new book, The Serpent's Promise, The Bible Retold as Science. I've been seeing quite a lot about this book in the papers, Steve. It seems to be getting quite a number of reviews. Before we look at the book, tell us a little of your own journey. How did you get into genetics and science and so forth?
by accident, needless to say. No, not really. I think almost every biologist has a guilty secret, which is that he or she started as a bird watcher. And that's certainly true of me. I was never particularly good as a bird watcher. I've never been particularly good as a scientist. But like Russell, I find it a very, very repaying way to spend your time. Not particularly financially repaying, but you're being paid, you're being employed to do what you enjoy doing and to do what you want to do, really, within the obvious constraints of finance and space and that kind of stuff. And as a result, over the last 40 years or so, I've become one of the world's top six experts on the genetics of snails, and the other five of us agree. It's a narrow, obscure field, unlike high-energy particle physics. But I had a lot of pleasure out of it. I may have even discovered something, although whether it'll change the world, I doubt.
But even Darwin had his special focus, didn't he, on,
barnacles.
Barnacles.
Darwin was the most astonishing individual. Because he, before he came up, of course, with the theory of evolution, he felt he had to become an expert on something, and it scarcely mattered what. And he spent 8 years dissecting and writing books on, unreadable books on.
Well, yeah, I was going to say, we don't tend to read those books so much,
well,
do we?
The odd thing is, his two books on barnacles are still the standard anatomical and paleontological books about barnacles, which is pretty good after 150 years.
It is. When it comes to faith, Steve, you're an atheist.
Yeah.
Have you ever kind of dallied with faith at any point in your life?
It's difficult to take oneself back. I certainly exposed to a large amount of it. I come originally from a Welsh-speaking and Welsh background in which my grandparents, certainly my mother's parents, who were very noble people, were deeply involved with the chapel, as much of rural Wales in those years was. And I went to chapel every Sunday. As the years went on, my parents then moved to England, to Liverpool's Left Bank, as I used to think of it, the Wirral Peninsula. I began to lose my Welsh, as I have more or less completely lost it now. But I was still obliged to go to Welsh-speaking chapel. Mm. And it was, looking back on it, it was really rather like the early days of the earlier days of the Catholic Church, where the congregation was being told something that they couldn't understand because it was in Latin.
But
they knew it was supposed to be good. And in some ways that immunized me, but I think the final protection against religion was, as for so many people, was religion in school. And that really was like the measles vaccine.
Well, that's interesting.
In other words,
a small dose and you get inoculated.
Exactly. Now, I have to say, I mean, I got a lot out of parts of religion in school, particularly, of course, you tend to forget the nobility of much of the language of the King James, which is, of course, a superb quality. You tend to forget the joyousness of singing in consort, even if you don't believe the words. Mm. And that really meant a lot to me and means a lot to me. I mean, I'm very interested in literature, I'm very interested in music. But I have to say, try as I might, I find it very hard to become a believer.
So you appreciate some of the cultural influences that Christianity has brought, but obviously you can't commit to the spiritual aspect. Interesting that Steve should bring up the inoculation that religion in school brought. Obviously, the work you're trying to do, Russell, is aiming to open up the questions in schools and so on. What about you when you were growing up? Did you have a faith? Was the education you received at school on that front, both scientific and religious, any influencer on your own spiritual journey?
I don't think it really did have any effect. I came from a family where my parents weren't religious. My mother went to church on Christmas Day, sort of thing. My father, he said that, you know, religion is something women do, you know. So that was that sort of background. The only memory I have of religious education in schools was it was taken by my physics teacher, and all he did was read Screwtape Letters to us, which I found very interesting. But that's the only thing I got out of that. What actually happened was that I went to a school called Archbishop Tennyson's Grammar School. It in fact overlooks the Kennington Oval cricket ground, which is why I'm very keen on cricket. And it was founded by Tennyson, who at that time was the vicar of St. Martin's in the Field. And so the school has an annual service, Founders Day service at St. Martin's in the Field. And I was school captain, and so I had to read a lesson there. And there was something about that church that I just felt at home in. I know that some people find that very strange. They find church a very sort of hostile kind of environment, you know, not very friendly. But I just found it, I just felt I belonged, you know. And I decided to take confirmation classes there. And the curate at that time was Austin Williams, who eventually became the vicar of St. Martin's in the Field. Again, I don't remember anything he taught me, but there was something about this man which I found, you know, deeply attractive. There was something about him that he had that I wanted. And it was a classic case of religion being caught rather than taught.
Mm, you know? Yeah. And as you went on in that journey, both in a scientific career and obviously with your developing Christian faith, were there any points of conflict, or was there essentially harmony between the two?
I wouldn't say conflict. Certainly puzzlement was certainly there, particularly when I took up a career as a scientist, and especially when eventually I became a reader in the Church of England. And you know, people just couldn't understand how I could wear a white laboratory coat Monday to Friday and then put on a white surplice and preach on a Sunday, you know. And so I was very much challenged. Well, okay, how do I marry these two together? Mm. And thinking about it, no, I never saw any conflict.
Okay.
No, I've never had any trouble with it.
We're talking about science and faith and potentially a conflict. Certainly these sorts of areas are covered in Steve's book, which we're going to be digging into as well in the programme today. If you've got any questions or thoughts, comments on today's show, I'd be very happy to hear from you as well if you're listening today. Why not email me, unbelievable@premier.org.uk, and I'm happy to read out some of your comments on next week's show and find out what you thought of today's show. And of course, anything very relevant, I can always be forwarded on by me to our guests today for their consideration as well. But my guests are Steve Jones, Professor, Emeritus Professor now of Genetics at University College London, regular columnist for the Daily Telegraph. We're looking at his book, The Serpent's Promise, The Bible Retold as Science. Steve is an atheist, but he's been looking at whether the Bible, at the time it was written, was meant to be seen in its way as a scientific sort of textbook for its day. Russell Stannard is a retired high-energy particle physicist, Professor Emeritus of Physics at the Open University. He's a Christian, and he is going to be interacting with Steve on some of the questions raised by the book. And the question, can science ultimately point to God in any sense? So I hope you can continue listening. Today we're here till about 4 o'clock this afternoon, and if you're listening on the internet, we're at premier.org.uk/Unbelievable.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Steve, this book, The Serpent's Promise, obviously a reference to the story of Genesis and when the serpent tells Eve that if you eat of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, you will be like God, you know, you'll have knowledge and so on. The concept of the book is very interesting. You suggest that you can read the Bible as talking about science. So where did this come from?
From my less than fertile imagination. I think the essential point about the book is that it is not a book about religion. It is not a book about theology. It's a book about science. Mm. Now, as all your listeners know, there is a very large literature of polemical works either that attack religion bitterly, often by scientists, and which is matched by an equivalently large literature which attacks the attacks on religion.
Indeed.
And that has always seemed to me a rather sterile duologue, really. And there's an enormous gap which people haven't explored, it seemed to me. I think of it as Dawkins Canyon, okay? It's the gap between the pros and the antis.
Okay.
But what about giving up the argument on pros and the antis, which really is not open to a scientific conclusion? You can make statements pro and anti the social aspects of religion, the roles of men and women. Women are much more liable to become religious than men. That's a matter of observation. All that is a perfectly reasonable field of discussion, and actually quite a lot of it comes in the last chapter of my book. But you can't use science. It would be foolish to imagine you could use science to talk about things which are outside science. Things like the notion of an afterlife. How do you test the notion of an afterlife? You simply can't. The existence of God. You can't test the existence of God with science. That strikes me as deeply foolish. And I make a considerable effort to avoid doing that. For example, in the book, I don't talk at all about the resurrection, because I do not see any scientific parallel which I could draw.
Okay.
And one of the reviews of this book have been rather interesting, but it's been a bit like the Dawkins versus the rest of the world conversation or non-concept conversation, which is either they are over the top in favour, which slightly embarrasses me, or they're equally over the top against. And one of the standard against ones is that I don't know any theology. Well, fair enough. I don't know any theology. I don't claim to know any theology. The reviewer who said that with considerable bitterness said I didn't say anything about the reincarnation of Christ. I thought, if I don't know any theology, you are of spectacular ignorance. I didn't know the Pope was a Buddhist. So I just don't see.
Yes, that, sure.
Now, the Bible as science is a separate issue. Mm. The Bible is, of course, many, many things. It's a work of art of superb quality. It's a work of history, much of which, or large parts of which, are clearly pretty accurate. other parts there is no evidence for. The Exodus, for example, there is no physical evidence for. It's a work, particularly in the Old Testament, it's a work which regulates one particular society. Judaic society, and has helped regulate, of course, much of the world's modern society. In the New Testament, it's a work which, unlike the Old, looks forward into the future. The New Testament is absolutely a work of the modern world. I think it marks the beginning of the modern world in many ways. And it tells us, gives us rules by which we should live. And the argument is there a scientific explanation of perhaps the biggest mystery of all, which is why are we so nice to each other? You know, it's very hard to know why a rather ordinary primate, you know, biologically we're extremely similar to our relatives, can live in groups of millions without, generally speaking, murdering one another. Yeah. None of our close relatives can live in a group of more than about 20 without splitting, bloodshed, all that kind of stuff. Maybe religion has done something to allow that. And that's the kind of thing you can ask questions about. The mystical stuff you can't, and I avoid it.
Well, you've had a chance to look at the book, Russell. What were your overall impressions of
be as rude as you like.
Don't hold back.
Well, first of all, Steve, can I say that I have a great admiration for your explanations of science, particularly genetics, which of course is not my specialism, and I learned a great deal from it. But I do find it extremely odd, to say the least, when you say that it is not a book about religion, that it's a book about science. As far as I'm concerned, it is a spiritual book. It's a book about God. It's about God in relation to ourselves. It is about the meaning of life. It's about how we should live our lives. It's how we should view this life, this mortal life, in the context of eternal life. That is what it's all about. Now, fair enough, there are points at which it touches on subjects which today we would regard as within the domain of science. I can well imagine that if Genesis was being written today, it would mention the Big Bang. It would mention evolution. But that is not what Genesis is actually about. If you go back to some of the early church leaders, they did not read Genesis as a literal account of what happened. Clement of Alexandria, Origen, St. Augustine, they read Genesis as allegory. For example, Origen said, "What man of sense could possibly believe that there could have been a first and a second and third day of creation before the sun had been created?" The sun supposedly created on the fourth day. You have St. Augustine saying, "In the beginning were created only the germs or causes of the forms of life, which were afterwards to be developed in gradual course." It was a kind of evolutionary theory. Now, I'm not saying he got there before Darwin, obviously, Darwin's theory of evolution by natural selection. But from the writings of St. Augustine, it's manifestly clear he was not reading Genesis as science, as a literal account. For example, Eve being made from a rib taken from Adam's side. That is simply saying man is not complete without woman. Woman is not complete without man. It's talking about the position of marriage.
So let's allow Steve to come back on this, because for you, Steve, Genesis is, as far as the writers of Genesis were concerned, the scientific account of its day.
For me, and 100 million American believers, it is, yes. It's very hard for me. I mean, Russell's argument, I've heard before, and he makes it very fluently, and it's clear that one can find early Christian writers who are no doubt people of great learning and intelligence who begin to use the M word, the metaphor word. But the difficulty is that vast numbers of Christian believers reject that utterly today and take it as the literal truth. And you can't, you know, you can't have your communion wafer and eat it. It is the case that there are...
But isn't Russell's point that regardless of what people may currently believe or not believe about the nature of Scripture, I think Russell's point is that when it was written, set down, it wasn't written to be understood in that fashion at that time?
Neither of us were there at the time. It's very hard to enter into the mindset of the many writers, many scribes who wrote the Testaments, particularly the Old Testament. The New Testament perhaps is a lot easier. So I don't... What I say is, and I believe it to be true, is that parts of the Bible are an attempt to make sense of the world around you, okay? And many of the questions which are asked by those scribes are trying to do that. Where does the universe come from? Where do we come from? What is the role of man and woman? Are we born with an inborn fate? Can we change that by our own volition? All these are, in the end, questions about the physical world.
Yes.
Now, what I've tried to do, and whether I succeeded or not, I don't know, is to ask those questions as if they're being asked today and to provide you with one scientist's view of today's answers. One of the things I'm absolutely certain of, and Russell Allen Noah would agree with me, that some of the things I say in that book are without question wrong. But we don't yet know that they're wrong.
I think one of your concerns, Russell, it strikes me, is that you're worried that Steve is perhaps setting up the Bible in a kind of a bit of a straw man argument to say, well, the Bible was trying to do science. It got it wrong because we know better today. And therefore, it's an out of date.
Therefore, we can get rid of the Bible.
Document.
And all you need to have today is popularizations of science written by Steve Jones and Russell Stanley. No, I don't go along. You're quite right, Steve, to point out all these people who, particularly in the States, believe in a literal interpretation of the Bible. And one cannot be absolutely certain as to what was in the minds of the original writers. But the best one can do is to go back in time as far as you can to find out how those early church leaders thought. And they treated it as allegory. Certainly, when you get to medieval times, just about every serious-minded theologian treated it as allegory. The literal interpretation of Genesis did not really come into its own until the time of the Reformation. And that's in the 16th century. And it came about because there were the Protestants breaking away from the rule of Rome. They were challenged as to what is your authority for doing this, for throwing over the authority of the Pope. And the Protestants said, it's the Bible. That's what we're sticking by, not the Pope, the Bible.
Essentially, a far more recent sort of way of looking at Genesis.
And you can actually date it to something like 1542, which is the Council of Trent stating in its rebuff against the Protestants that we believe that the Bible was written at the dictation of the Holy Spirit.
I'm going to pause you there because we need to go to a break, I'm afraid. I hate to break it off mid-flow. But we're talking today, the Bible, can it be retold as science? That's the claim of Steve Jones' new book, The Serpent's Promise. He's with me today. He's an atheist, a geneticist. Russell Stannard is our Christian guest, a high-energy particle physicist by background. So two scientists with different views on faith joining me in the studio today. And we're going to be asking other questions as well as we go along in today's programme. You're listening to Unbelievable here on Premier Christian Radio. Don't forget, you can find us online as well at premier.org.uk/unbelievable.
Is science and religion incompatible? If you're a youth group leader and you want to start a discussion in a way that engages young minds, try Science and Belief, an exciting resource now available online. Simply gather your group together, download the leader's notes, watch one of 12 fascinating short videos on YouTube, and let the mind-expanding conversations begin. And there's an online questionnaire, as we'd love your feedback. Visit retoday.org.uk/scienceandbelief.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
A topic we often touch on in one form or another on today's show with me, Justin Brierley. Can the Bible be retold as science, we're asking? It's a science-faith discussion. Can science point to God as well? I think that's an important question that we need to get to in this section of the programme. My guest today, Steve Jones, is Emeritus Professor of Genetics at University College London. An atheist, his latest book is The Serpent's Promise, the Bible retold as science. Russell Stannard disagrees with the central premise, though, of Steve's book. Russell is our Christian Science guest today. He's filmed a number of short videos called Science and Belief, The Big Issues. They're available on YouTube and at the RE Today website. You can check that out at retoday.org.uk/science. Gentlemen, the disagreement we've had between you is whether it's you're allowed to talk about the Bible as a sort of attempt to do science. Now, I suppose the point is that what we call science has changed a lot in the last few centuries. Because I don't know if it's fair to say that what the ancients did when they tried to understand the world around them was what the moderns do in that sense, Steve.
I think it's not that different, actually. I mean, as I often say, if you want to see science in action, go to a primary school. Children do science all the time, from birth onwards. They work out how gravity works, they work out how to balance on a swing and that kind of stuff. They're doing physics. They're interested in their own bodies. I once made a television program about snails with, I think the kids were about 8. They were absolutely riveted by it, far more than my first-class honours undergraduates at University College London. So I think science, curiosity, is central to the human experience. Okay, I think in some ways it's what makes us human. Mm. And it's perfectly understandable that we come up with explanations for the world around us. And I stick to my claim, even in spite of my deep ignorance of theology and Origen and all these people, I stick to my claim that what large parts or notable parts of the good book are doing are looking at the world around us and saying, how did it come to be this?
Now, and, I mean, you quote from things like Psalms and the book of Job. Yeah. Obviously, there's that conversation between Job and
God. You can't not quote from the book
of Job. Yeah, exactly. And you have this sort of, conversation between God and Job. You know, where were you when created the Earth's foundations and so on. And for you, Steve, is this for you, the author of that book, doing science at that point, trying to
he's asking sensible
happened.
Questions.
Right.
And he's getting answers which, to me, don't make as much sense as those provided by science. I mean, the problem to me, really, and I reiterate my statement, this is not, to me at least, the person who wrote the book, this is not a theological book. Mm. The problem, the great French mathematician and physicist Laplace is said to have said, he probably didn't actually, it was used against him, but the Emperor Napoleon, who was a highly intelligent man, came to him and looked, he wrote a book about the cosmos, Laplace, and Napoleon asked him, why was there no mention of God in your book? And Laplace is said to have replied, I have no need of that hypothesis.
Yes.
And that's really my view. You can, by all means, like, as Newton did. Newton wrote far, far more about the book of God's words, the Bible, than the good book of God's works, the universe, because he saw them as the same thing. But in all truth, Newton's writings on theology and mysticism have disappeared, whereas his writings about physics helped make the modern world. And I don't myself feel, and clearly Russell doesn't agree with me, that writing about science without reference to any final cause is in any way disrespectful of the Bible. Final cause is not needed.
When you read the book of Job, Russell, What do you take away from that? Clearly, you take a different sort of message away than the one that Steve is suggesting was intended by that author.
Well, going back to this Laplace supposed comment, in a way, I completely agree with that. Now, as a scientist, I don't need the God hypothesis. Now, why is that? The job of the scientist is to explain the world, how the world is constructed, the structure of matter, the structure of the cosmos, what are the laws of nature that govern the behavior of that matter. And you certainly don't need a God to engage in that kind of research, okay? Mm-hmm. But I want to go further than that, further than my role as a scientist. And by that I mean, in the first place, one, I think, has to ask, why is there a world in the first place? The job of the scientist is to explain the world, but it's not within science to explain why there is a world in the first, why there is existence. And many people, if they are trying to adopt an intellectual approach to God, will define God as the ground of all existence. Paul Tillich said, the ground of all being. Okay, so that is asking a question which is outside and goes beyond science. And if you're then talking about, you know, what is the purpose of life, again,
this isn't science, the realm that science can... I saw an interesting notice board recently outside a church. It said, there are some questions that can't be answered by Google. And I thought, well, you could say the same of science. And you're nodding your head in agreement there, Steve. But isn't your point then, Russell, that the Bible is not there for those scientific questions?
No,
it's there
not.
For those value, purpose.
There are points where it does touch on topics which today we would classify as being coming within science. Okay, and I think that in the light of our scientific understanding, it does make you look at the Bible with different kinds of spectacles on. And I think one has to adopt this kind of realistic attitude towards them, which is not to rule out all miracle stories, but to treat them all with a measure of skepticism. And I think that is perfectly consistent with being a bona fide Christian.
Sure. Let's talk about the aspect of when you do science, because one of the interesting things that I think you've spoken of in terms of the relationship between science and religion is that for you, Russell, a lot of scientists do science without thinking about the bigger questions of why can we do science in the first place. And I understand it, you believe to some extent that it's hard to explain the ability to do science without reference to a higher intelligence, if you like,
I think it's perfectly easy to do science.
Yes, the question, I suppose,
but why did you don't ask the deeper question, well, why is there a world to operate and to experiment on in the first place? Now, I think many scientists just perhaps regard that as a meaningless question. It seems perfectly meaningful to me. But they regard it as a...
Make of that question then, Steve?
I have to say, it seems to me, if not a meaningless, an unanswerable question. And if a question is unanswerable, it's not worth asking. So that's my view of it. I always think of science as the refuge of the mediocre, people like me, who are not particularly intelligent. But
you're being very...
I mean this very seriously. There's a lot of false modesty in the world, and I'm not, and I'm as infected with it as anybody else. But I have to say, with a fair amount of confidence, my research over the last 40 years has not transformed the world of biology. Okay, however, it has added a small grain to our mountain of knowledge. Now, to me, and I'd be slightly rude here, that's more than the entire efforts of theology in the last 2,000 years, because it's there. It's probably right what I've done. Somebody else, cleverer than me, can move on and find something new. Whereas theology and the discussions of the philosophy of science, which to me, again, is not a subject in which I or 99% of my colleagues have any interest whatsoever, that doesn't move on. That doesn't look forward.
Right.
It looks back. And I like to look forward.
Well, that's very interesting, and you look like you want to respond.
Yeah, I there is certainly a difference between science and religion. To some extent, religious people look back. With most world religions, there is some figure in the past, Jesus, Muhammad, Moses, who is an authority figure, and one does look back as far as how to live one's life. One can't do better than that of Jesus. One looks back. But to conclude from that theology does not advance is completely wrong. You start off with Jehovah being one God amongst many gods. it was only once one began to realize the true nature of God as revealed by the whole succession of prophets that you eventually get to the idea of one single God, the God who's in charge of everything, the God who is the creator of everything, a God of love and forgiveness. Now, that is an enormous change and progression in understanding as we think.
Now, does this count for you, though, Steve, as a sort of a valid form of advance of knowledge?
In all frankness, no. You could say... If I had no feeling for music, I could say that music has not advanced since J.S. Bach. Mind you, I'd probably be right when I say that. But, and of course, that would be an entirely foolish thing to say. And it may well be that I am simply, as the majority of scientists, simply faith blind. You know, I'm tone deaf to it. And if I were tone deaf, I wouldn't, as I do, listen with my headphones on to Radio 3 2 or 3 hours every day. So it could simply be that. It could be a failure of understanding on my part. And I'm very happy to accept that. But if it's there, it's there. It's why I have a failure of understanding. But the book is not about that.
Sure.
I mean, one of the things I've been quite astonished by in the reviews, and you know, if you can't take it, don't dish it out. I mean, I've written some nasty book reviews, and I don't mind my book being reviewed nastily, which it has been in a couple of places. Is the intense sort of peevishness which reviewers have taken for daring to suggest that the Bible somehow has an element of scientific inquiry in it, and I don't understand why they get so worked up about it. This is a notion. It's a hook. It's a MacGuffin, as people sometimes say. It's the key of writing a book about science from a different point of view. And to say that, for example, let's take the most banal chapter in the book, which is the chapter about the Great Flood. Okay, it's absolutely clear that there have been great numbers of enormous floods in biblical times, in Sumerian times, at the end of the last ice age. And it's highly likely that these were hijacked by the writers of Scripture as evidence of God's displeasure. And we have Atrahasis, who came long before with his great flood. And most religions have great floods in them because there are great floods. Now, it seems to me a perfectly legitimate effort to do what I've done is to take this idea of great floods and ask not whether they were sparked off by God, but whether they were sparked off by tsunamis, for example, or melting ice in the ice age. And I do not see why people with a theological interest find that somehow insulting. It's a mystery to me.
Do you find it insulting?
Well, can I go back to, you bring up this question about music, you know, no progress in change of music, but I quite agree with you there. A couple of days ago, I went to a concert of Vivaldi. One of my favourite composers is Schoenberg. Okay, they are different, and I enjoy both today. But where religion is concerned, if I compare some of the pictures of God in the Old Testament to the God revealed by Jesus Christ, I don't think that early version was as good. I don't worship that God of the Old Testament God in the way that I worship the new one. For me, there's been an improvement.
Well, my wife, as it happens, is Jewish. So she's not religious, but she comes from a long line of people with religious belief. How would you explain your view to her? Because she believes in the Old Testament God.
I would want to ask her, does she really believe that her God does not care a fig about Egyptians?
The point about, you know, we're talking about, if we talk about my book, this is not what my book is about.
Sure.
At all.
I think, though, but what we are addressing is the question of whether religion, theology, spirituality can address questions in a meaningful way. And I think what you've suggested is, no, they can't, not in the way that science can.
That says two things. I think the first part, the answer is, for many people, yes, of course they can. And as a believer in the freedom of religion, I feel strongly that people should be allowed to practice their own faiths, insofar as they don't interfere with the beliefs of other people. So I'm a strong believer in the freedom of religion. Many religious people, of course, are not. There aren't many churches in Saudi Arabia. But however, and I'm very happy that Russell, for example, clearly gains a great deal from his faith. And I'm pleased and happy to learn that. I don't share that. And I do feel that you can be a perfectly excellent scientist without
of
faith.
Course. I don't think Russell would disagree with that.
Which I think all scientists actually in their own way are excellent because they all do the same thing, realizes the limits of science. Oddly enough, my own science, genetics and evolution, and indeed Russell's to a degree, tend to be the ones to which people with religious interest turn, because they purport to tell you about what happened in the past. People are deeply interested in the past. I'm certain, that we are the only animal that's deeply interested in the past, that even understands there is a past and there will be a future. Okay. Now, these are questions which in some senses, Big Bang theory approaches, in some senses, evolutionary theory approaches, but they do so scientifically. And religion has that has nothing to do with religion.
Well,
religion has nothing to do with that.
If I can sort of try to sort of paraphrase what Russell's been saying, I think his view was that we talk about an advance in religion or whatever, as a Christian, he believes that we have been given, if you like, a better understanding of who God is, the nature of God, the character of God through Jesus Christ. That's why Russell is a Christian. And yes, that will at some level trump other views of God that are there that you know in the past or in other cultures and so on, but for Russell that's answering a question that's very important, the nature of God, a question that science simply cannot answer. And isn't that a valid question with valid ways of looking at it and seeking for answers
outside the realm of science. You're basically almost quoting from the preface of my book.
Well, quite. But you've said that those questions are not. You don't get. Essentially, you're saying you just don't get as good answers as you get from science.
Let's stand back from the problem. Let's talk. For example, I mean, Russell may think this is a cheap example, but it's very real to me, which is not the fact that scientists have disproved the existence of God or don't like the existence of God. That's simple foolishness. They have nothing to do with each other. But the fact that many believers resist the advance of science. And now I teach regularly evolutionary biology. I go to many schools and universities and talk to students about evolutionary biology. In the last 10 years, more and more and more, I have been harassed and threatened by students with Islamic belief who are passionate that this cannot be true because of their belief. Now, I think we have to remember that there is an attack not by science on religion, but increasingly by religion on science.
Yeah. Can I join forces with you on that, Steve? I think there's a poll which shows that physicists tend to be more inclined to be religious than biologists.
Physicists are smarter than biologists.
I think part of the reason for that is that you have these fundamentalist religious believers who simply will not accept evolution, and they attack biology in a perfectly disgraceful way, and I can well understand you and Richard Dawkins getting incredibly incensed by the sheer stupidity of the arguments they put forward, and what I do not understand, Steve, is if they take exception to evolution, why don't they also as vehemently attack me over Big Bang?
Well, I know. It is
And they don't. And the reason is because emotional things, they don't like being descended from the ancestors of monkeys and stuff like that. It is not a reasoned argument. No, it's sheer emotional nonsense. I just feel very sorry for biologists.
I sometimes wonder, though, as well, and I don't know what you make of this, but that the nature of the different types of science that physicists and biologists are doing perhaps has some reason for why there might be a difference. So, for instance, biology, very much concerned with the world as it is now, the cellular life, and how it progresses into the future. Physics, obviously, looking back to some degree as to the start of the universe, and that kind of raises different kinds of questions in the mind of perhaps a scientist, because it might naturally ask, well, if Big Bang Theory is true, it does sort of leave this question hanging in the air: what lit the blue touch paper,
well, yes,
as it were, and that kind of thing.
That's the God of the Gaps argument, which is never very convincing, really. In the end, I think I'm very happy to say that physicists in general are cleverer than biologists. I mean, that I think all biologists, apart from Watson and Crick, would agree with that. And Crick,
for instance, I know Russell, that you've talked about the fact that physics is about exploring the laws of the universe, but then that raises another question about why are there laws? Why is the universe so intelligible?
I
suppose that's where I'm coming from when I say perhaps there are these meta questions that physics raises.
I think you're right that it's probably easier for a physicist from their type of investigation to slip out of the science into a somewhat more sort of deeper question, and in fact not quite sure where the science ends and the metaphysics begins. Like, for example, Stephen Hawking, in his popular book A Brief History of Time, he describes there how there is a well-known understanding that perhaps the Big Bang saw the coming into existence not only of the contents of the universe, but also of space and time, that there was no time before the Big Bang. And he then, okay, that is science, mm-hmm, okay, mm-hmm. Is there time before the Big Bang? Okay, that's science. But then he says, okay, in that case, there can't be a cause of the Big Bang, because cause comes before effect. And where the Big Bang is concerned, there's no before. Okay, mm-hmm. So that's, again, mm-hmm. It's a scientific statement. But then he goes on to say, what place then for a creator? Now, there he steps out of the science and shows himself to be a very poor theologian, because what he's doing is making a very elementary mistake that professional theologians would think of, where he's confusing two words, origins and creation. Origins is all about how things originate, how they get started, and as such is of no interest to a theologian. They're not interested as to how things get started. Theologians are interested in the creation question, which is, why is there something rather than nothing? Why are we here today? What is responsible for existence, for which their answer is God? Then Hawking, having been taken to task on that, in his latest book, The Grand Design, he says, okay, I have now taken this on board. I have now answered the question, why is there something rather than nothing? And the answer is M theory. M theory is the idea that there might be a law of nature, the function of which is to create universes. It spontaneously creates universes out of nothing. It created this universe. It creates many, many other universes. And therefore, you don't need God. And in fact, in a front page headline in the Times newspaper was Hawking, God did not create the universe.
Yes.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Again, he's making a simple mistake. Okay, M theory might be the answer as to why there is a universe, but why is there M theory? Where did that come from?
Yeah, it's a case of the I suppose to you, Steve, when it comes to these kinds of questions, in the end, will that always just be a subjective view, whereas science always provides an objective way of looking at reality? These kind of questions of meaning, purpose.
I think that's too stark a contrast, really. I mean, you tend to forget that science is done by scientists, and scientists are just as frail and feeble and possibly as anybody else. They're arrogant, many of them. Not me, needless to say.
Don't name any names.
So, you know, it's a human endeavour with all the faults that implies. But I think that scientists are interested in science and not in ultimate causes. The interest in ultimate causes is not what scientists do, generally speaking. To ask what came before the Big Bang is like asking what's north of the North Pole. Yeah. There's you know, it's not a question that makes any sense.
Well, it's a different kind of question, I suppose. Let's take another break, and we've just got 5 minutes or so to wrap things up today. We're talking about science and belief. Steve Jones's new book, The Serpent's Promise, is part of what we're talking about, and he's in conversation with Russell Stannard today, who's a retired high-energy particle physicist. What do you think? Is science answering a completely different set of questions to the sorts of questions the Bible is there to answer? We'd be interested to hear from you. unbelievable@premier.org.uk. Come back for the conclusion of today's programme in a moment's time.
Do the Bible and science really contradict each other? Is there really a historical Adam and Eve? These are only a few of the questions that seem to indicate an apparent conflict between science and faith, and this is why Reasons to Believe exists. RTB's mission is to demonstrate that sound reason and scientific research consistently support, rather than erode, confidence in the truth of the Bible. Our work shows how the record of nature and the record of Scripture reveal the God of the Bible as Creator, Lord, and Saviour. Find out how you also can give a sceptical world reasons to believe. Visit us today at reasons.org.
Welcome back to Unbelievable with me, Justin Brierley. This is the third and final part of today's show. And just a reminder that we'll be hearing the final part of the discussion between Russell Stannard and Steve Jones as we look at science, faith and the Bible today on the programme. Just a reminder as well that next week you can come back for a full roundup of what happened at Unbelievable, the conference 2013. A week ago, Saturday the 25th of May, we had a wonderful day of teaching, listening, being inspired to go and give good reasons for the Christian faith from a variety of excellent speakers, including Alistair McGrath, Amy Orr Ewing, Peter S. Williams, Fuz Rana, Trevor Stammers and Kurt Jaros, all in connection with our conference partners, Reasons to Believe, Real Clear Apologetics and RE Today Services, who, of course, Russell Stannard represents in the videos for Science and Belief. Well, it was a great day at the brewery in London, and so I'm going to be telling you all about it next week. We'll be hearing some of the audio, and if you want to get hold of the videos of the sessions, the seminars, well, we're not doing a DVD this time round. That's what we've done the last 2 years. We're actually going to be making this stuff available online this time, so do listen out for more details about that, and when it's ready we will obviously let you know here on the show via email. If you came to the conference and we've got your details, you'll be sent the links and so on, so that's something to look forward to. But I really did enjoy getting to meet so many people at last week's conference. An exhausting day, but a really, really worthwhile day. So we'll be hearing a little bit of your feedback to that towards the end of today's show, as well as a whole mailbag full of emails to past editions of the show too. And of course, we'll be hearing some of the actual content on next week's programme. Come back for that at the same time, Saturday, 2:30 p.m. or online at premier.org.uk/unbelievable.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
Just concluding our discussion on whether the Bible can be retold as science, and can science point to God? My guests today have been Steve Jones, Emeritus Professor of Genetics at University College London, a regular columnist for the Daily Telegraph, and his latest book is The Serpent's Promise, The Bible Retold as Science. Russell Stannard is the Professor Emeritus of Physics at the Open University, a former recipient of the Templeton Prize. He's a Christian, and he's filmed a number of short videos recently called Science and Belief, The Big Issues, suitable for use in schools and churches. You might want to check them out on YouTube or at the RE Today website. That's retoday.org.uk/science and belief. We've talked quite a lot, gentlemen, about the kinds of questions that science and faith are purporting to answer, and whether I think it was Stephen Jay Gould who talked about non-overlapping magisteria, this idea that religion and science are seeking to answer different things, never the twain shall meet. I don't know what you make of that.
Well, Steve, who I knew well, he's one of the the other top six world experts on the genetics of snails. I felt that was a deeply dishonest book, actually, to be frank with you, because it swerves round the truth, which is that there is an enormous conflict between science and religion, particularly in the United States, in that being a scientist is made more and more difficult by the spread of untruths among large numbers of people. And Steve wanted to, as I have already said, wanted to have his communion wafer or his or his kosher pickle and eat it. He wanted to accept the fact that many people had an irrational view of the world, other people had a rational view of the world, and that was perfectly okay. You pour treacle over it and everybody's going to be happy. And he was rather vilified by the scientific community behind the scenes about that book. It was regarded as rather a cowardly book, and I think you really can't get away with that. You can't say you're both right. If religion stayed on the grounds of religion, then that would be absolutely fine. But religion constantly has this, it seems like an obsession, to stray onto the grounds of science. Science doesn't often go in the opposite direction. Some people try, Richard Dawkins may try, and I think to a large extent they fail. But no wonder we are a bit defensive.
OK, what do you make of that attempt to sort of explain the role of science and religion?
I think it's complicated. I think to some extent there's truth in the idea that religion sometimes is dealing with questions which are quite distinct from what can be approached in a scientific way. But I think that's being simplistic. I think, for example, if you go back to Genesis, the taking of the fruit, the idea of being selfish and self-centered and, you know, doing things your own way sort of thing. Well, okay, this gives rise to the idea of original sin, that for the moment of conception we have this tendency to be self-centered. Mm. Well, if you come over to biology, a modern understanding, part of the DNA coding is to do with genetically influenced behavior patterns that have been fashioned in the so-called struggle for survival. And so one would expect that coded into that DNA, you might have a code which tends indeed to point you in the direction of looking after number one so that you survive to the point where you can have your own offspring sort of thing. So I would see that as an occasion where science has something very useful and interesting to say, which actually backs up an insight that is there in a religious book, in Genesis. Yeah. So I see the relationship as being much more complicated than just being two separate items.
Mm, mm. And ultimately, Steve, you don't seem to disparage those big why questions, the what are we here for, what's the purpose. You seem to be saying, yes, these are questions that science isn't set up to deal with. But at the same time, you're obviously sceptical of the ability of religion, Christianity, to give us definitive answers in this area, in the way that science has been successful.
I think that summarises my view rather well, because the science is the art of the sceptic. Okay, science is for pessimists. What you're constantly trying to do is to destroy, not of course your own theories, but somebody else's theories. Okay, and it's a destructive pastime. And I'm constantly, as I mentioned, being criticised by students and others for talking about the theory of evolution and the fact that the world is not 6,000 years old. It's clearly entirely stupid to say that it is. The evidence is overwhelming that it's not. But if by some, what's the word, miracle, I was, through my extensive research on mollusks, able to show that the world started 6,000 years ago in an instant, fully formed, I don't think I will, I would immediately become the most famous scientist in the world, okay? Because science is the art of disproof, yeah, of disbelief. Belief is the art of belief. Now, once a scientist has faith in his findings, he or she has stopped being a scientist, because he or she is not willing to accept that they might be wrong. And that's really where it rubs against me the wrong way. But don't get me wrong, I am very happy, and I've known Russell for a long time, that people like Russell, who take great comfort from his views, and to some degree, perhaps I even slightly envy that. I'm very happy with that, but I'm a scientist. As I said to my publisher, when we got these rather wretched reviews from a few people about this book, I said, now, look, I don't mind if these believers, hundreds of millions of them, I don't mind if they burn my book as long as they buy it first. And that, I think, summarises my argument.
All right. Thank you very much for being with us. Thank you also, Russell, for being with us. I suppose in the end, for you, when you go into church on a Sunday and you go into the laboratory on a Monday to Friday, or when you used to, for you, it was part of a whole that you were looking at. Did you see a sharp dichotomy between those two activities?
I see them as being very close, even to the extent that, as Steve has just been saying, in science, our understanding of the world is always provisional. We're always open to the idea that our current ideas need refining and improving. And that is exactly my attitude towards my religion, that, I'm continually open to the idea that my understanding of God is provisional, and as I go through life having more diverse experiences, it enriches and perhaps changes in some ways my understanding of God. So to me, they are both very similar enterprises. In fact, it's a kind of integrated approach to just generally understanding everything I encounter.
Mm. Thank you very much for being with us. Thank you, Steve. And if you want to check out Steve's book, I'm going to obviously post a link to where you can get hold of it with the podcast of today's programme. So if you're looking for more information on both Russell and Steve, why not check out the Unbelievable webpage at premier.org.uk/unbelievable. You can find today's programme there, information on my guests, where to find The Serpent's Promise by Steve Jones, and of course a link to the Science and Belief, The Big Issues series of videos via the RE Today Services website. That's retoday.org.uk/science and belief. In the meantime, thank you, gentlemen, both for being on the programme today. It's been a fascinating discussion between you. Some areas of agreement, some areas of disagreement, but thank you very much for being in with me today.
Thank you.
And if you'd like to get in touch yourself, I do encourage you to send in your thoughts via email and also via Twitter and Facebook and so on. I can imagine some of the views put forward by both sides today there will be voices that want to express reservations, differences of opinion, agreement. Why not get in touch? And I'll give you the ways to do that in just a moment's time as we look at some of your feedback to the last few weeks of programming. You're listening to Unbelievable with me, Justin Brierley.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Well, just a reminder, if you want to get in touch, I welcome your emails. That's unbelievable@premier.org.uk. And don't forget, you can also phone your comment in if you'd like, and I'll try and play that out. I haven't had many phone calls recently, so possibly time to reiterate the number if you want to call and leave a voicemail message. It's 08456 52 52 52, and select the option for leaving a message for Unbelievable, and I'll happily play that out, or a snippet of it out, on a coming programme. Lots of people have been getting in touch about recent shows. I'm going to read out some of those. Don't forget, you can also get in touch via the Facebook site, facebook.com/unbelievablejb, and you can follow that, you can like that to get updates on what I'm talking about, and links of interest. Also the Twitter account for the same thing, twitter.com/unbelievablejb. That's the handle. So last week's conference, what a wonderful time was had. It was so great to meet so many listeners of the show, and also new friends, people who hadn't really come across the show before, had perhaps been brought along by a friend or heard about it at their church. So if you're listening today because you came along to the conference, then welcome along the good ship Unbelievable. It's good to have you on board, and I hope you'll get a lot out of listening to the show from here on in. As I mentioned earlier, this year's conference video is going to be made available online, so listen out for more details of that. Once they're ready, I'll obviously let you know here on the show, and indeed, if you came to the conference and gave us your contact details, you'll find out via email too. There were some lovely people I met, not least the chap who collared me and said, I have to tell you how I discovered Unbelievable. He said, I was at a football match, And I saw, from where I was sitting, someone commentating in a commentator's box. And I thought, perhaps that's on a local radio station. So I tuned in on my personal transistor to some of the local medium wave frequencies. I didn't find him, but I found your voice on Premier Christian Radio, the first time I'd ever tuned in, and started listening to the show regularly from then on, and came along to your first conference. So there you go. That was one person's way of... hearing about the show, completely randomly tuning in from a football match. Thanks also to all of those other people I spoke to, more than I could possibly mention now, but it was lovely to hear some of your stories of what you've gotten out of the show, how you're approaching Christian apologetics in your own personal journey. Fabian from Munich probably deserves a special mention. Yes, he flew in specially for the conference from Munich in Germany. And also the US visitor, whose name I'm afraid escapes my memory now, but who extended his stay in the UK in order to be able to take in the conference, which was very kind indeed. And I'm sure there are many others too. If you do want to tell me what you thought about the conference. I've had a number of responses already, and it's been great to see how enthusiastic they have been. But if you'd like to let us know what you thought, and indeed what we could do to improve it in the future, then do, of course, email, as ever, unbelievable@premier.org.uk. Well, let's go to some of your feedback, because I haven't had as much time as usual to go through some of this. So I'm going to just set aside a little more time on today's show to do that. Just a few general hellos. First of all, Austin says, I've been listening to the show a couple of years. Some things just seem to work, don't they? The whole programme is pitched just right to be accessible and yet intellectually challenging, all in an environment of mutual respect. Thanks very much. And I'm coming to the conference for the first time this year as well, so looking forward to that. Thank you very much, Austin. Perhaps I met you, perhaps I didn't. Either way, thank you for sending in that rather lovely email. Julian got in touch with me last autumn because he wanted to link the Unbelievable site to his new website. And, well, he's got it running now and a podcast associated with it as well. Wondered if I could give a shout out. Certainly can. It's called themindrenewed.com. You say you're an evangelical Christian trying to stand for Christ in the alternative media scene. At heart, this is an apologetics ministry, but of a rather unusual sort. My philosophy is to engage with controversial subjects while testifying to Christ and meeting objections to the Christian worldview along the way. In doing so, I'm trying to model Christian engagement with a significant subculture, which many people, including Christians, too often ignore. But I do so critically and always with the intention that the truth of Jesus being upheld. I'm well aware that many would reject what I'm trying to do, but I believe it's a legitimate area for ministry to an audience of real people who are too often dismissed and ridiculed. So because of the controversial nature of this podcast, you may decide not to promote it. I fully understand, but I'm grateful for any support you feel able to give. Well, I'm quite happy for others to make the judgment as to what they think of the podcast. And I'll just say that if you want to go and look at that, themindrenewed.com is the website where you can access that podcast, looking at some controversial issues from a sort of apologetic standpoint. Elizabeth Hall is a new listener in the USA, says, I've just become aware of your programme. I've just downloaded 29 shows to listen to while I'm on vacation. One thing I noticed as I went through the list is that there are episodes dedicated to various Christian groups, Roman Catholic, Calvinist, etc., and to cults, but I see nothing on the Eastern Orthodox. I know that Orthodox churches exist in Great Britain. One of the most influential theologians of today is from there, Bishop Callistos Ware. I think you should consider doing a programme on the beliefs of Orthodoxy. Thank you very much. Not the first time someone has suggested that, Elizabeth, that something of a lack of Eastern Orthodox perspectives on the show, and I'll see what we can do down the line. David in Battleground, Washington, in the USA. What an interesting place to live, Battleground. I discovered your back catalogue of the radio show last year. I've been catching up. Your many fine shows have helped me get something straight in my head that has long been bothering me. This problem might also be bothering your other listeners, so I thought I'd share my thoughts. There seem to be four kinds of faith portrayed in your shows. I call them justified faith, hopeful faith, blind faith, and delusion. Justified faith is faith that relies on logic, solid evidence and peer review. This is the faith of doctors and engineers. Hopeful faith relies heavily on logic and peer review but doesn't yet have all the evidence it's actively seeking. This is the faith of explorers and scientists. Blind faith relies on logic, but quality evidence is no longer required, and in fact evidence is here considered a personal thing, not subject to peer review. This is the faith of apologetics and of the more intelligent religions. A delusion doesn't require sound logic, creates evidence where there is none, and couldn't care less about peer review. This is the faith of the superstitious mind that speaks in tongues and plays with poisonous snakes. All four kinds of faith claim to have knowledge, but I've decided that while blind faith can often be amusing, only justified faith has a compelling claim to true knowledge. David, I'm assuming, and don't get me wrong, I have sometimes made the call wrong, but I'm assuming you're probably an atheist on the basis of that sort of demarcation of these types of faith that you think are out there. I would simply say that knowledge claims obviously vary between different disciplines, and what would claim be a knowledge claim, for instance, in science might be a different thing in history, poetry and all kinds of areas. I can only assume you haven't sort of come across many very good apologists if you believe that quality evidence isn't required in the field of apologetics. I'd encourage you to go and, you know, maybe look at some of the top apologetics sort of sites and books and arguments that are out there. And I think they would beg to differ that evidence is very much at play, good evidence in the arguments that are being made for the existence of God and the reliability of scripture and so on. Whether or not it falls into your other categories of justified faith or hopeful faith. But thank you. It's an interesting one to receive. Tim says, I know we really don't know each other, but I wanted to say thank you for your show. Mainly because of your show, I'm now a campus director of a thing called Ratio Christi on an Edinburgh campus in Edinburgh, Pennsylvania, in the States. It mentors college students in giving reasons for their faith. I'm also taking a few Biola classes in apologetics. It's largely due to what you've done on the show. It's made me want to pursue this with more passion than ever. I'm currently a tech director at a church, but that had given me opportunities to lead things such as support groups and a doubt class that has helped a few people with big questions. Again, just wanted to say thank you for all you do. Please keep it up, Tim. Thank you so much, Tim. So encouraging to hear that there in the States you've been encouraged to really engage with apologetics in a new way since listening to the show. And there was someone else I met, very similar story at the conference, who had said that the show had really been an introduction to looking into apologetics in a much bigger way in their life. Thank you very much. Now, going to some shows of recent note, Adam and Eve, a couple of weeks ago, did they really exist? Three different views from different Christians were on the table. Fuzz Rana giving an old earth creation view, believing that there is evidence, both scientific and biblical, for a first human couple. Then there was Dennis Alexander as a theistic evolutionist with the view that if there was a first human couple, they were part of the evolutionary story and, as it were, had some kind of God-breathed consciousness into them. And Peter Enns, probably the furthest out on that spectrum, seeing that we have to not see the Genesis story as a origins account at all, that we've perhaps been misinterpreting it for a long time. Anyway, interesting stuff from then. Tim in Kobe, Japan, says, the limited time each of your guests had to make their points and respond to the opposing viewpoints meant a lot of things were left hanging. I'm sure that Fuzz Rana would have a lot to say about the evidences Dennis Alexander mentioned to support his Darwinian evolutionary view. In principle, I suppose that God could have directed a Darwinian-style, gradualism-only evolutionary process in a way we couldn't scientifically detect, but the fossil record doesn't support that. And the various evidences Alexander mentioned have been falling by the wayside one by one the more we learn about the genome. The recent ENCODE project has identified critical functions for more than 80% of the human genome, the vast majority of what was previously presumed to be evolutionary junk. And I wouldn't be surprised if function is eventually identified for the rest as well. While there is a huge amount we don't yet know concerning genetic information, the trend is clearly moving away from a Darwinian explanation and towards a purposeful design explanation. Let's follow the evidence wherever it leads, says Tim. And another perspective, again on this, from Craig in Los Angeles, says, Justin, you did get the right mix for that topic on the historical Adam. All three guests are Christians and old Earth advocates. It was good to hear Fuzz Rana on with someone who can defend a Christian view of evolution in Dennis Alexander, and to be able to counter the idea of one original human couple. Peter Enns is an excellent biblical scholar and is leading the discussion here in the States on the interpretation of Genesis and the Old Testament. Excellent choice for a panel on this topic. Thank you. I'm glad you enjoyed the show as well, Craig. Maybe time just to fit in a couple of emails that came in on the show of a week before. Amy or Ewing doing a responding to a few questions from different atheists on the line. She was one of our guests, of course, at this year's conference. Thanks for the great Gorilla Christian with Amy Orr Ewing, says Paul, a youth worker in Birmingham. The discussion I found most interesting was with your caller Rachel, who brought up spirituality and her appreciation of Buddhist meditation. Given that new atheism is apparently now making the way for the new atheism, and people like Alain de Botton, for example, I think questions about what, if anything, Christianity has to say on spirituality will be coming up more often. New atheism was about arguments to engage the head, but if even atheist hearts are softening to the idea of making certain spiritual practices part of their lives, then Christians need to have some answers ready to give. We have deep traditions of spirituality and prayer, practiced in different times, places and ways, culturally relevant and theologically rich, but many of us don't know our own heritage, about how to pray liturgically or with icons, how to use prayer beads, about what makes Christian meditation unique, or about traditions such as Ignatian, Benedictine or Franciscan spirituality, not to mention the many Reformed spiritualities. They are uniquely Christian because Christian prayer, like the Christian faith, is incarnational. They proclaim Jesus' salvation is for both body and soul, which in turn points to the Son becoming human in order to return with us to the Father. My hope is that Christian prayer, properly understood, will be an important way to preach the gospel in the future. Thank you very much. Andrew, on that same subject, says, thanks for an enjoyable episode. I liked Amy's warm style of apologetics and her courage to answer questions directly. I really wanted to thank Rachel for correcting the stereotypical view of meditation and asking about its use in Christian worship. In the Atheist Bible on Wikipedia, there's a link between meditation and Christianity. Saint Padre Pio stated, through the study of books, one seeks God. By meditation, one finds him. It also talks about meditation in Christian worship. Christian meditation is a term for a form of prayer in which a structured attempt is made to get in touch with and deliberately reflect upon the revelations of God. I go to a Buddhist centre and a Baptist church and see a healthy overlap between the two because they both meet people where they're at, encourage selflessness and provide a social framework to help people work through the trials of life. Andrew himself, I think, has been on the show, of course. Andrew Nightingale is an atheist, but sort of still goes to church. So interesting place that you're on, I know, Andrew. I think we're just about out of time, so we're going to have to leave it there. Many more emails I wanted to try and get to on abortion and the Rob Bell episode and all kinds of things. But thank you anyway for being in touch. And as I say, do listen out in future episodes for news of how you can get hold of some of that conference material, the videos and so on. If you were both there but obviously couldn't go to all the seminars that were on offer or weren't able to be with us but would like to find out about it, that's all to come. And next week on the show, you'll be able to hear some of the audio from that conference.
You're unbelievable.
Yes, I'll be bringing you a roundup of some of the aspects of last week's conference. You'll be hearing the opening address by Alistair McGrath for the conference and some of the panel Q&A as well, when the audience got to ask a whole range of questions to do with apologetics and Christian faith of a range of speakers that we had at the conference. So come back at the same time for next week for a bit of a roundup of Unbelievable, the conference 2013, which will be looking ahead to when you can actually get hold of the videos online as well. So for the moment, thank you for being with me today on the show. I'm Justin Brierley, your host. Do come back same time, same place next week. And until then, have a great week.